Good evening. This is the Education Hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. I'm Sue, VK4ST. This evening, Adam, VK4KSS, is going to illuminate us with a brief history of lighting before and after the electric light bulb. When someone is the centre of attention, we often say they are in the limelight. Have a listen to Adam and find out where this expression comes from, and some other fascinating facts about lighting. Tonight, Laurie, VK4KST, talks to us about the invention that started the Industrial Revolution, the steam engine. The steam engine was the most significant invention ever, as it released mankind from much of the hardship of physical labour and led to the first means of rapid transportation across land and sea. Ron, VK2DQ, talks to us about heat and temperature. Are heat and temperature the same? When did we really start to measure temperature? Have a listen to Ron as he answers these questions. Also tonight, we learn a little about superconductors and superconductivity from the University of Houston. Why do we say bless you when someone sneezes? Sneezing was an early warning sign that a person may have caught the feared plague called the Black Death. Could mankind have benefited from such a terrible plague? The University of Houston discusses this possibility tonight. Please stand by for this evening's program. Now Ron, VK2DQ, talks to us about temperature and heat.
Before modern times, heat was never really measured quantitatively. It was enough to say, this is hot, or this is cold, or this is warmer than that. In order to measure temperature quantitatively, it was necessary to discover something that changed materially with temperature, and that change needed to be uniform. One such change was found in the fact that substances expand when warmed and contract when cooled. Galileo was the first to try to make use of this fact to detect changes in temperature. In 1603, he inverted a glass tube of heated air into a bowl of water. As the air in the tube cooled to room temperature, it contracted and drew water up into the tube, and thereby Galileo created the very first, albeit primitive, thermometer. The word thermometer comes from the Greek thermos, meaning heat, and meter, something we're all familiar with. Meter means measure, so thermometer means heat measure. When the temperature of the room changed, the water level of the tube changed. If the room warmed, the air in the tube expanded and pushed the water level down. If the room temperature grew cooler, the air contracted and the water level moved up. The problem with Galileo's thermometer was the column of water in the tube that he used was inverted into an open vessel of water, and air pressure also affected the level of the water in the tube. So if the air pressure became greater due to meteorological effects, then the column of water in the tube would change according to changes in air pressure as well. So his thermometer was sensitive to both temperature and air pressure. Galileo had, in effect, created a thermometer and a barometer. The thermometer was the first important scientific instrument ever to be made of glass. By 1654, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Ferdinand II, had evolved a thermometer that was independent of air pressure. It contained a liquid sealed into a bulb to which a straight tube was attached. So the whole thermometer was enclosed in a glass envelope consisting of a bulb and a long tube. The contraction and expansion of the liquid alone was used as the indication of temperature change. Liquids change their volume with temperature much less than gases do, but with a large reservoir of liquid and a filled bulb, so that the liquid can only expand up a very fine narrow tube, the rise and fall within the tube, even for tiny volume changes, can be made to be considerable. The English physicist Robert Boyle did much the same thing about the same time. He was the first to show that the human body had a constant temperature, and that the temperature of the human body was markedly above that of room temperature. Using these primitive thermometers, experimenters began to discover that many physical phenomena take place at fixed temperatures. For example, before the end of the 17th century, it was found to be the case that melting of ice and the boiling of water always occurred, provided they were the same height above sea level. The melting of ice and the boiling of water always occurred at the same temperature. The first liquids used in thermometry were water and alcohol. Since water froze too soon and alcohol boiled away too easily, the French physicist Guillaume Ametons resorted to mercury. In this instrument, as in Galileo's, the expansion and contraction of air caused the mercury level to rise and fall. In 1714, the German physicist Gabriel Daniel Fahrenheit combined the advances of the Grand Duke and Ametons by enclosing mercury in a tube and using its own expansion and contraction with temperature as the indicator. Furthermore, Fahrenheit put a graded scale on the tube to allow the temperature to be read quantitatively. There is some argument about exactly how Fahrenheit arrived at the particular scale that he used. He set zero, according to one account, at the lowest temperature that he could obtain in his laboratory by mixing salt and melting ice. He then set the freezing point of pure water at 32 and its boiling point at 212. This had two advantages. First, the range of the temperature over which the water was liquid came to be 180. 32 to 212 is 180. This seemed to be natural to use in connection with degrees, as there are 180 degrees in a semicircle. Secondly, body temperature came to be near 100 degrees. Normally, it is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit to be exact. So constant is body temperature normally that if more than a degree or so above the average, the body is said to run a fever and one has a clear feeling of illness. In 1858, the German physician Carl August Wunderlich introduced the procedure of frequent checks of body temperature as an indication of the course of disease. In the next decade, the British physician Thomas Clifford Allbutt invented the clinical thermometer, which has a constriction in the narrow tube containing the mercury. The mercury thread rises to a maximum when placed in the mouth, but does not fall when the thermometer is removed. The mercury thread simply divides at the constriction, leaving a constant reading in the portion above. In the United States, the Fahrenheit scale is still used. At least to my knowledge, it's still used. The Fahrenheit scale in the United States and many other countries is still very familiar, used today to report everyday affairs such as weather and in the use of clinical thermometers. In 1742, however, the Swedish astronomer Anders Celsius adopted a different scale. In its final form, this set the freezing point of water at zero and the boiling point at 100. Because of this 100-fold division of temperature range in which water is liquid, this is called the centigrade scale, from the Latin words meaning 100 steps. Centigrade means 100 steps. Many people still speak of measurements on this scale as degrees centigrade. But scientists, at the International Conference in 1948, renamed the scale after the inventor, following the Fahrenheit precedent. Officially, then, one should speak of the Celsius scale and of degrees Celsius. The symbol C still holds. It was Celsius's scale that won out in the civilized world. Even the United States is attempting to accustom people to its use. Scientists in particular found the Celsius scale far more convenient. Temperature measures the intensity of heat, but not the quantity of heat. For example, in the upper atmosphere, in the top ends of the ionosphere, we see that there are temperatures sometimes up into the thousands of degrees Celsius. And I've often been asked, how can spacecraft get through these extremely high temperatures? Well, there are extremely high temperatures in the upper atmosphere, but there is very little heat there. You do not have to have a great quantity of heat to have a high temperature. Heat will always flow from a place of higher temperature to a place of lower temperature until the temperatures are equal, just as water will flow from a high level to a lower one until the levels are equal. Heat behaves so regardless of the relative amounts of heat contained in the bodies involved. Although a bathtub of lukewarm water contains far more heat than a burning match, when the match is placed near the water, heat goes from the match to the water, not vice versa. Joseph Black was the first to make clear the distinction between temperature and heat. In 1760, he announced that various substances were raised in temperature by different amounts when a given amount of heat was poured into them. Black also showed, which at first seems to be a little bit astonishing, Black also showed that it was possible to pour heat into a substance without raising its temperature at all. When melting ice is heated, melting is hastened, but the ice does not rise in temperature. Heat will eventually melt all of the ice, but during the process, the temperature of the ice itself never goes above 0 degrees centigrade. Likewise, with boiling water at 100 degrees Celsius, as the heat is poured into the water, more and more of the water boils away as vapor, but the temperature of the liquid does not change whilst it is boiling. In the case of heat, as of light, there were two theories. One held heat to be a material substance which can be poured or shifted from one substance to another. It was named caloric, from the Latin for heat. According to this view, when wood was burned, the caloric of the wood passed into the flame, and from it into the kettle above the flame, and from it into the water of the kettle. As water filled with caloric, it was converted to steam. That theory turned out to be not correct. In the late 18th century, two famous observations gave rise to the theory of heat as a form of vibration. One was published by the American physicist and the adventurer Benjamin Thompson. A Tory who fled the country during the Revolution, was given the title Count Rumford and then proceeded to knock around Europe. While supervising the boring of a cannon in Bavaria in 1798, he noticed that quantities of heat were being produced. He found that enough heat was being generated to bring 18 pounds of water to the boiling point in less than 3 hours. Where was all the caloric coming from? Thompson decided that the heat must be vibration set up and intensified by the mechanical friction of the borer against the cannon. In other words, heat had nothing to do with caloric. Heat was about vibration. Here, the chemist Humphry Davy performed an even more significant experiment. Keeping two pieces of ice below the freezing point, he rubbed them together, not by hand, but by a mechanical contrivance, so that no caloric could flow into the ice. By friction alone, he melted some of the ice. He, too, then concluded that heat must be a vibration and not a material. Actually, this experiment should have been conclusive, but the caloric theory, though obviously wrong, persisted until the middle of the 19th century. So there we have it. The definition of heat is molecular vibration, and temperature is the measure of the velocity of that molecular vibration. Well, that's all for me for this week. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
This is the weekly education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Some materials used in these sessions may be copyright to the respective authors.
This is the Engines of Our Ingenuity, made possible by the University of Houston and the Friends of KUHF. Today we ask how an invention is born. The University of Houston's College of Engineering presents this series about the machines that make our civilization run and the people whose ingenuity created them. Let's ask whether inventions fight their way into the world from inside inventors' heads, or are they made in response to worldly needs? Look at the steamboat. It was reinvented dozens of times before Fulton, but it never caught on. When Fitch ran a steamboat line in Philadelphia 20 years before Fulton, he couldn't attract enough passengers to pay for it. Of course, Fulton made a much better boat in 1807, but what's more important is that by then, there was a public demand for the steamboat. Compare that with the invention of man-made superconductors. In 1911, mercury was found to have no measurable electric resistance below about 4 degrees Kelvin. During the next 75 years, scientists found natural superconductors, all the way up to 23 degrees Kelvin. Of course, this wasn't invention, it was just scientific reporting. But the practical promise of superconductivity is so great. By getting rid of electric resistance, we can work technological feats of near magic. In fact, the U.S. Navy has for some time used superconducting generators in certain ships. It takes a helium cryostat to cool them, but these high-tech generators save far more weight and costs than the cryostats add. A few years ago, scientists began to see that it might be possible to invent superconductors that would work at higher temperatures, above the boiling point of inexpensive nitrogen coolant, maybe even at room temperature. The break came in 1986 when two Swiss scientists, Müller and Bednarz, discovered a superconducting oxide. Then Paul Chu at the University of Houston rapidly created oxides that were superconducting at twice the temperature of any natural material. Pretty soon he went well beyond the boiling point of nitrogen. Suddenly, the dream of practical superconductors could be realized with man-made materials. It could be done by invention. And the race was on. The public didn't have to be convinced about the value of this invention. Electrical industries went to war over it. And the race to make practical superconducting systems has spawned remarkable tales of determination on the one hand, and intrigue and espionage on the other. So, what is the stimulus for invention? Well, Fulton studied water transportation for years before his sudden success. And Paul Chu actually began his search for man-made superconductors back in the 1970s, when the task still seemed hopeless. It's nice when the public welcomes your ideas. But it's the human mind, and not mere necessity, that mothers invention. I'm John Leinhardt at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
Please stand by for Laurie, VK4KST, as he talks to us about the steam engine.
Tonight, I would like to talk to you about the steam engine. The great turning point in the harnessing of energy came at the end of the 17th century. Although there had been a dim foreshadowing in ancient times, the Greek inventor, Hero of Alexandria, sometime during the 1st century AD, interestingly, his life cannot be pinned down even to a particular century, built a number of devices that ran on steam power. He used the expanding push of steam to open temple doors, whirl spheres, and so on. The ancient world, then in decline, could not follow up on his premature advance. Then, over 15 centuries later, a new and vigorously expanding society had a second chance. It arose out of the increasingly acute necessity of pumping water out of mines that were being driven ever deeper. The old hand pump made use of a vacuum to lift water, and as the 17th century proceeded, human beings came to appreciate even more keenly the great power of a vacuum, or rather, the power of air pressure called into play by the existence of a vacuum. In 1650, for instance, the German physicist and mayor of the city of Magdeburg, Otto von Guericke, invented an air pump worked by muscle power. He proceeded to put two flanged metal hemispheres together and to pump the air out from between them through a nozzle that one hemisphere possessed. As the air pressure within dropped lower, the air pressure from without, no longer completely counterbalanced, pushed the hemispheres together more powerfully. At the end, two teams of horses straining in opposite directions could not pull the hemispheres apart, but when the air was allowed to re-enter, they fell apart by themselves. This interesting experiment was conducted before important people, including on one occasion the German Emperor himself, and it made a big splash. Now, it occurred to several inventors, why not use steam instead of muscle power to create the vacuum? Suppose one filled a cylinder or similar vessel with water and heated the water to boil. Steam as it formed would push out the water. If the vessel was cooled, for example by means of cold water played on the outside surface, the steam in the vessel would condense to a few drops of water and leave a virtual vacuum. The water that one wanted to raise as out of the flooded mine could then rise through a valve into this evacuated vessel. A French physicist, Denis Papin, saw the power of steam as early as 1679. He developed a steam digester, then in which water was boiled in a vessel with a tight-fitting lid. The accumulating steam created a pressure that raised the boiling point of water and at this higher temperature, cooked food faster and better. The steam pressure within this digester must have given Pepin the notion of making steam do work. He placed a little water at the bottom of a tube, and by heating it, converted it to steam. This expanded forcibly, pushing a piston ahead of it. The first person to translate this idea into a practical working device, however, was an English military engineer named Thomas Savery. His steam engine, the word engine originally denoted an ingenious device and comes from the same Greek root as ingenious, could be used to pump water out of a mine or a well or to drive a water wheel, so he called it the miner's friend. But it was dangerous, because the high pressure of the steam might burst the vessels and pipes, and very inefficient. Because the heat of the steam was lost each time the container was cooled. 7 years after Savery painted his engine in 1698, an English blacksmith named Thomas Newcomen built an improved engine that operated at low steam pressure. It had a piston in a cylinder and employed air pressure to push down the piston.
This is the weekly education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.
Newcomen's engine was not very efficient. It still cooled the chamber after each heating, and the steam engine remained a minor gadget for more than 60 years until a Scottish instrument maker named James Watt found the way to make it effective. Hired by the University of Glasgow to fix a model of Newcomen's engine that was not working properly, Watt fell to thinking about the device's wasteful use of fuel. Why, after all, should the steam vessel have to be cooled off each time? Why not keep the steam chamber steam hot at all times and lead the steam into a separate condensing chamber that could be kept cold? Watt went on to add a number of other improvements, employing steam pressure to help push the piston, devising a set of mechanical linkages that kept the piston moving in a straight line, hitching the back and forth motion of the piston to a shaft that turned a wheel, and so on. By 1782, his steam engine, which got at least three times as much work out of a ton of coal as Newcomen, was ready to be put to work as a universal workhorse. In the times after Watt's steam engine, efficiency was continually increased, chiefly through the use of even hotter steam at higher pressures. Carnot's founding of hydrodynamics arose mainly out of the realization that the maximum efficiency which any heat engine can be run is proportional to the difference in temperature between the hot reservoir, steam in the usual case, and the cold. In the course of the 1700s, various mechanical devices were invented to spin and weave thread in more wholesale manner. These replaced the spinning wheel which had come into use in the Middle Ages. At first this machinery was powered by animal muscle or a water wheel, but in 1790 came the crucial step. It was powered by a steam engine. Thus, the new textile mills that were being built had neither to be situated on or near fast-moving streams, nor to require animal care. They could be built anywhere. Great Britain began to undergo a revolutionary change as working people left the land and abandoned home industry to flock to the factories, where working conditions were unbelievably cruel. Until society learned, reluctantly, that people ought to be treated no worse than animals. The same change took place in other countries that adopted the new system of steam engine power, and the Industrial Revolution, a term introduced in 1837 by the French economist Jérôme Blanquoir. The steam engine totally revolutionized transportation too. In 1787, the American inventor John Fitch built a steamboat that worked, but it failed as a financial venture, and Fitch died unknown and unappreciated. Robert Fulton, a more able promoter than Fitch, launched his steamship, the Clermont, in 1807 with so much fanfare and support that he came to be considered the inventor of the steamship, though actually he was no more the builder of the first such ship than Watt was the builder of the first steam engine. Fulton should perhaps better be remembered for his strenuous attempts to build underwater craft. His submarines were not practical, but they anticipated a number of modern developments. He built one called the Nautilus, which probably served as an inspiration for Jules Verne's fictional submarine of the same name in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, published in 1870. That, in turn, was the inspiration for the naming of the first nuclear-powered submarine. By the 1830s, steamships were crossing the Atlantic and were being driven by screw propeller, a considerable improvement over the side paddle wheels, and by the 1850s, the speedy and beautiful Yankee clippers had begun to furl their sails and be replaced by steamers in the merchant fleets and navies of the world. Well, that concludes the first half on the steam engine. Until next week, take care.
This is the weekly education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Can there be any good to come from a plague? The University of Houston thinks so. You decide for yourself.
Today, we survive the Black Death. The plague, Yersinia pestis, swept out of Asia in 1347. An overpopulated Europe had been damaged by 50 years of famine. Now rats carried this disease off ships in Genoa. In just 4 years, it killed off 40% of the people in Europe. It took three forms. Bubonic plague hit the lymph system. Pneumonic plague attacked the lungs, and septicemic plague assaulted the blood. But the words Black Death encompassed it all. After 1351, the Black Death went from the epidemic phase, where the disease suddenly appears, to the pandemic phase. During the so-called plague pandemic, the plague settled into the local environment and kept coming back every few years to whittle away at the population. From the first famines in 1290 until the plague pandemic began to recede in 1430, Europe lost three-quarters of its people. The Black Death is far and away the greatest calamity our species has ever suffered. And what do you suppose was left in its wake? Well, it unraveled the tapestry of the feudal system. It left many survivors wealthy. Manual labor became precious. Wages skyrocketed. And work took on a manic quality. When death rides on your back, time also becomes precious. Minutes seem to count for something. The church-centered world before the plague had been oddly timeless. Now people worked long hours chasing capital gain in a life that could end any moment. The first new technology of the plague years was timekeeping, mechanical clocks and hourglasses. Medicine had been a function of the church before the plague. Physicians were well-paid, highly respected scholars. They spun dialectic arguments far away from unwholesome sick people, not unlike some of today's specialists. 13th century medicine, like the 13th century church, had failed miserably in coping with the plague. Both medical and religious practice now shifted toward the laity. Medicine was redirected into experimentation and practical pharmacology. Medical books were now being written not in Latin, but in the vernacular, and by a whole new breed of people. Technology had to become less labor-intensive. It had to become high-tech. For good or evil, the plague years gave us crossbows, new medical ideas, guns, clocks, eyeglasses, and a new craving for general knowledge. And so the rainbow at the end of this terrible storm yielded its pot of gold. The last new technology of this ghastly 150 years was the printing press. It finally melted what Shakespeare had named the winter of our discontent. It provided access to knowledge, and it started the rebirth of Europe. I'm John Leinhardt at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
Please stand by for Adam VK4KSS as he discusses lighting before and after the electric lamp.
Good evening. This is Adam VK4KSS. This evening I'm going to be speaking to you about artificial light before electricity and the electric light. Of all the tricks performed by electricity, certainly the most popular was its turning night into day. Human beings had fought off the daily crippling darkness after sundown with the campfire, the torch, the oil lamp, and the candle. For half a million years or so, the level of artificial light had remained dim and flickering. The 19th century introduced some advances in these age-old methods of lighting. Whale oil and then kerosene came in to be used in oil lamps, which grew brighter and more efficient. The Austrian chemist Baron von Welsbach found that if a fabric cylinder impregnated with compounds of thorium and cerium were put around a lamp flame, it would glow a brilliant white. Such a Welsbach mantle, patented in 1885, greatly increased the brightness of the oil lamp. Early in the century, gas lighting was introduced by the Scottish inventor William Murdoch. He piped coal gas to a jet where it could be allowed to escape and be lit. In 1802, he celebrated a temporary peace with Napoleon by setting up a spectacular display of gas lights, and by 1803 he was routinely lighting his main factory with them. In 1807, some London streets began to use gas lighting, and the custom spread. As the century progressed, large cities grew even lighter at night, reducing the crime rate and enhancing the security of citizens. The American chemist Robert Hare found that a hot gas flame played upon a block of calcium oxide, lime. Such limelight came to be used to illuminate theatre stages to a brighter level than had ever been possible. Although this technique has long since been outmoded, people who are in the blaze of publicity are still said to be in the limelight. All of these forms of lighting, from bonfires to the gas jet, involve open flames. Some devices must exist to light the fuel, be it wood, coal, oil, or gas, if the flame does not already exist in the vicinity. Prior to the 19th century, the easiest method was to use a flint and steel. By striking one against the other, you could make a spark that might, with luck, light some tinder, which could in turn light a candle, and so on. In the early 19th century, chemists began devising methods for coating one end of a piece of wood with chemicals that would burst into flame when the temperature was elevated. Such a piece of wood was a match. Friction would raise the temperature, and striking a match on a rough surface produced a flame. The earliest matches smoked horribly, produced a stench and made use of chemicals that were very, very dangerous. Matches became really safe to use in 1845, when an Austrian chemist used red phosphorus for the purpose. Eventually, safety matches were developed in which the red phosphorus is put on a rough strip somewhere on the box, while the match itself has the other necessary chemicals in its head. Neither match nor strip can alone burst into flame, but if rubbed on the strip, the match catches fire. There was also a return to flints and steel, with crucial improvements. In place of steel is mish metal, a mixture of metals, which, on being scraped by a little wheel, yields particularly hot sparks. In place of tinder is easily inflammable lighter fluid. The result is a cigarette lighter. Open flames of one sort or another flicker and are a constant fire hazard. Something totally new was needed, and it had been long been noted that electricity could yield light. Leyden jars produced sparks when discharged. Electric currents sometimes made wires glow upon passing through them. Both systems have been used for lighting. In 1805, Humphrey Davy forced an electric discharge across the airspace between two conductors. By maintaining the current, the discharge was continuous, and he had an electric arc. As electricity became cheaper, it became possible to use arc lamps for lighting. In the 1870s, the streets of Paris and some other cities had such lamps. The light was harsh, flickering, and open, however, and still a fire hazard. It would be better to have an electric current heat a thin wire or filament. Naturally, the filament had to be made to glow in the absence of oxygen, or it would not last long before being oxidized. The first attempts to remove the oxygen involved the straightforward route of removing air. By 1875, Crookes had devised a method of producing a good enough vacuum for this purpose, and with sufficient speed and economy. Nevertheless, the filament used remained unsatisfactory, breaking too easily. In 1878, Thomas Edison, fresh from his triumph in creating the phonograph, announced that he would tackle the problem. Thomas Edison was only 31, but such was his reputation as an inventor that his announcement caused the stocks of gas companies to tumble on the New York and London stock exchanges. After hundreds of experiments and many frustrations, Edison finally found a material that would serve as a filament, a scorched cotton thread. On October 21, 1879, he lit his bulb. It burned for 40 continuous hours. On the following New Year's Eve, Edison put his lamps on public display by lighting up the main street of Menlo Park, New Jersey. He quickly patented his lamp and began to produce it in quantity. Yet Edison was not the sole inventor of the incandescent lamp. At least one other inventor had about an equal claim, Joseph Swan of England, who exhibited a carbon filament lamp at a meeting of the Newcastle-on-Tyne Chemical Society on 18th of December 1878, but did not get his lamp into production until 1881. Edison continued to work on the problem of providing houses with a steady and sufficient supply of electricity for his lamps, a task that took as much ingenuity as invention of the lamp itself. Two major improvements were later made in the lamp. In 1910, William David Coolidge of the General Electric Company adopted heat-resisting metal tungsten as the material for the filament. And in 1913, Irving Langmuir introduced the inert gas nitrogen in the lamp to prevent the evaporation and breaking of the filament that occurs in a vacuum. As it turns out, argon serves the purpose even better than nitrogen, because argon is completely inert. Krypton, another inert gas, is still more efficient, allowing a lamp filament to reach higher temperatures and burn more brightly without loss of life. For half a century, the clear glass of the light bulb made the glowing filament within harsh and as difficult to look at as the sun. A chemical engineer, Marvard Pipkin, devised a practical method of etching the glass of the bulb within. The coming of the electric light had the potential for banishing all open flames from lighting, and thus making fires very much a thing of the past. Unfortunately, there are still open flames and probably always will be, in fireplaces, gas stoves, and in oil and gas furnaces. The glowing filament of the light bulb is not the only way of turning electricity into light. For instance, the so-called neon lights introduced by French chemist Georges Claude in 1910 are tubes in which an electric discharge excites atoms of neon gas to emit a bright red glow. The sun lamp contains mercury vapour which, when excited by a discharge, yields radiation rich in ultraviolet light. This can be used not only to produce a tan, but also to kill bacteria or generate fluorescence. And the latter, in turn, leads to fluorescent lighting, introduced in its contemporary form in 1939 at the New York World's Fair. Here, the ultraviolet light from the mercury vapour excites fluorescence in a phosphor coating inside the tube. Since this cool light wastes little energy in heat, it consumes less electric power. A 40-watt fluorescent tube supplies as much light and far less heat than a 150-watt incandescent light. Since the Second World War, there has been a massive swing towards fluorescence. The first fluorescent tubes made use of beryllium salts and phosphors, which resulted in cases of serious poisoning induced by breathing the dust contained in these salts or by introducing the substance through cuts caused by its broken tubes. After 1949, other far less dangerous phosphors were used. The latest promising development is a method that converts electricity directly into light without the prior formation of ultraviolet light. In 1936, the French physicist Georges Destreau discovered that an intense alternating current could make a phosphor, such as zinc sulfide, glow. Electrical engineers are now distributing the phosphor through plastic or glass and are using the phenomenon, called electroluminescence, to develop glowing panels. Using this method, a luminescent wall or ceiling can light a room, bathing it in a soft coloured glow. The efficiency of electroluminescence is still too low, however, to allow it to compete with other forms of electrical lighting. My name is Adam, VK4KSS. Thanks for listening, and I trust that you've been somewhat enlightened.
These programs are brought to you by the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society. Some materials used in these sessions may be copyright to the respective authors. If you are interested in becoming a licensed radio amateur, the Radio and Electronics School has a course to suit your needs.
You have been listening to the weekly education hour of the Gold Coast Amateur Radio Society.